One More Time is a 1920s vaudeville musical set in New Orleans at the Lyric Theater. After the show opened in Philadelphia, Vernell Banarese, who conceived, directed, and now stars in the show, joined us on Fresh Air and told us about his theater background and his interest in the 1920s. I told him that in a few weeks we'd be moving to new studios and that with our new music studio, perhaps he'd be able to demonstrate some musical examples of the period One More Time is set in, New Orleans of the 1920s. So it's a great pleasure for me to welcome back now Vernell Banarese, creator, star of One More Time, and with us also Morten Larsen, the Norwegian pianist who recently came to New Orleans and is now the pianist for the show. Morten is at the piano. Vernell's going to do a bit of singing, and we're going to talk also about the music of New Orleans. By the way, One More Time, if you haven't seen it, is held over until August 31st at the Schubert Theater in Philadelphia. Morten, welcome to Fresh Air. Vernell, welcome back to Fresh Air. And I'd love it if we could hit the tune.
Hit it.
A cake not to save your soul. Jelly roll is sweet, knocks me off my feet. Yeah, and it can't be beat. Well, I ain't gonna give nobody none of this jelly roll. I wouldn't give you none of it not to save your soul. My mama told me today when she went away, don't you give nobody no jelly roll.
That's great. Verna, how did you find Morten?
I was doing a show in New Orleans One More Time. And Morten used to come and see the show quite often. And afterwards, the cast, who were all real New Orleans people and the band, would get together in the cafe outside the theater and just jam from 11 o'clock till 4 and 5 sometimes. And Morten would sit in on the jam sessions, and then I picked up one of his albums, and I just got more and more intrigued by the, I don't want to say duplication, but real authentic quality that he has of Jelly Roll Morten.
Now, Morten, you had learned about this music from your home in Norway. Why did you come to New Orleans?
I came to the jazz festival. They have a jazz festival every year in April. And I came there the first year in 1977 with a Norwegian group. We finally got a job to play at the festival. And we came back the year after because we liked it so much. And even the year after that, in 1979. So then finally I heard about the show. And when the original company of One More Time was going to move from New Orleans to New York last fall, they needed a new company to set up, and including that, a new band. And it's sometimes hard to find pianists in the right style.
When you were in Norway, you'd probably heard a lot and maybe read a lot about New Orleans. What did you think you were going to find, and how did that compare with what you did find when you got there?
What I listened to in Norway was mostly recordings from the 1920s, what the classic jazz musicians made. And in New Orleans, I got to hear the music they play at Preservation Hall. That means how the musicians of today, the old musicians, play this style. I mean, they were born and played in the 20s, but they have stayed in New Orleans and played this style for a long time. And it's slightly different from what you hear in the 20s.
Vernell, you probably, having lived in New Orleans, see a lot of people coming to it from different parts of the country and the world, trying to capture for real what they'd read or heard about. What do you think of all the people who converge on New Orleans. How do you, as a native, regard them?
Well, it's very complimentary to the music and to people that were really my ancestors of the music. A lot of people, I'm interested in it, and I feel very good with it, because for a long time, blacks, young blacks, had a social stigma connected to the music and didn't really want to play it. And the Europeans were really the people that helped preserve it, the young Europeans that have come over. So I'm very delighted that they came and not only preserved the music, but in a way helped instill back a dignity into it.
Maybe we could do a little more preserving here and do another tune.
Well, we did a very interesting one the first time. Which one are we going to do?
I don't know.
What about Whining Boy?
Yeah, I was thinking the same. Yeah.
That sounded terrific. that's a tune by Jelly Roll Morton. Morton, how does Jelly Roll Morton's piano style compare to like the ragtime pianists of the period? It's not really ragtime. He's recorded some rags, but I don't think you could call him ragtime.
Yeah, certainly related to ragtime, but he did a lot of more things to it than the ragtime pianist did. The classical ragtime we know by Scott Joplin is a very formal, written down music, and what Jelly Roll did, he took this music and he added improvisation and blues elements to it, and he also put a more free rhythmic sense to it. I might be able to demonstrate it by the famous Maple Leaf Rag. Most people know that as a classic ragtime piece, it sounds, the first theme sounds about like this. Jelly Roll arranged changed it. As I said, he made a slightly smoother rhythmic approach to it, so it might sound about like...
Oh, that sounded great. A lot of Jelly Roll Morton, a lot of Morton Larson in that as well. Oh, now, how did you learn to play? From studying formally or from listening to a lot of records, picking it up from that, the jazz aspect of your playing? Because I know you've also studied classical music.
Yeah, I studied classical music in Norway, but I got interested in this music through reading about it mostly. And I started listening to records simply. And I started being interested in ragtime. And then also in traditional jazz, because I started playing with a band, and then it sort of melted together into Gerald Morton's piano style, which is something exactly in between, as you might understand.
Now, something like what you just played, if you're trying to get a sense of how to play that from listening to records, is it a complicated thing to work out, or can you do that pretty easily from just listening a lot? Do you have to hours working that out?
Oh, yeah, you have to spend hours, certainly, and listen to it like 10 or 20 times or something. But if you have an ear that picks up the pitches rather well, it's easy to work out, for me at least. But it's like a thing you can work on for years. I mean, when you try to learn the piece for the first time, you get to the surface of it. And then if you go back 2 years later and listen to it, you find much more things.
I was just I just finished reading Charlie Parker's biography, mm-hmm. and there's quite a bit in there about a time when he visited Sweden and was absolutely astounded at the kind of reception he got there, because he was used to, in his own country, being treated like first of all a black person, which meant not being treated very well, and his music wasn't accepted outside of the jazz world. And when he went to Sweden, he was a star, and he was astonished. And the fact that he was black did not mean that he was going to be treated like a second-class citizen. Now, growing up in Norway, what was your reaction to black American music and to black musicians? What was the racial sense of that for you?
Yeah, it's as simple as we don't have anything like that really in Norway, because we never had a big racial thing like here in America. So we are able to treat this music as music, wherever it comes from, and it is as valuable as any white music. Yeah. It doesn't make any difference.
But now, have you traveled to any European countries?
Yeah, sure.
Is there a difference between the way jazz is treated in European countries and how it's treated here?
Oh, completely, yeah. Like I say, like he said, they don't really have a stigma attached to it mentally, and they don't. For example, even as a kid, I've recently been able to get into gospel music, because I was brought up Catholic and white nuns right over me, and middle class parents saying that's for those people and you're not supposed to listen to all that noise and screaming. And because of all of the tension placed on the music, I couldn't enjoy it. Now I'm just, you know, I'm rocking on Sunday mornings.
Now, Morton is a white musician. Did you think anyone was going to accuse you of compromising the music if you had a white pianist playing for the show?
No. Early on, I was dealing with that whole reality. And I had to come to terms with myself. Earlier in the program, I mentioned how the European musicians were the first as far as bringing the music back and adoring the old jazz musicians as legends and, you know, really giving them their due. And One More Time is a celebration of all that, a 1980s celebration. So I really don't get involved on the racial side. Maybe it was an all-black band at the Lyric, but I know from some historic things that, for example, it wasn't all-black because Tio was in the band, who was a Mexican. There were foreigners even at the Lyric. Now, we do have American whites in the band now that we're going to different towns. But like I say, it's all wide open now.
I was just reading a little bit by Wilfred Millers, who's written some stuff about American classical music and jazz. And he said something interesting about Jelly Roll Morton, which I thought I'd just quote and ask you what you thought of it, Vernell. He said that, Morton's parents, I think, were both French, and he was a very light mulatto. And Miller's right that this produced an odd sense in him, that he felt that the black element both compromised his respectability but was also evidence of his artistic truth. From what you know about Jelly Roll Morton, how would you react to that?
Well, not only just Jelly Roll Morton, to any, to in Creole in general, you know, the Creole Society in Orleans in general, that is, I had to deal with that one more time. There is that European influence on Creoles, and it is a sort of, it's a compromise. Artistically, when you do a black project, because culturally you don't want to wash away your own thing through the great American vat. You don't want to stick your culture in that. So you want to continue to be a Creole New Orleans Negro or black person. But when you're doing a black project, and it is true that there is that compromise against you're selling out the Creole side of you to the black thing. But in all honesty, the Creole thing has its deep roots in black culture. So it all goes down to the voodoo and the African and the drum. So it's the only way to tell the truth if you do an art project, is to go down to the very root of it, and that is African.
You, like Jelly Roll Morton, are light-skinned. Was it ever a thing for you that you could possibly, if you wanted to, pass for white?
Oh, sure, yeah. I have people still asking people in the cast if I'm black now, you know, black audience members. I could have taken that as being a really horrible thing earlier in my career when there were films like Sound and Mandingo and Jane Pittman, and all these things were being filmed and friends of mine were being cast. I wasn't, because I was too light to be in the field as a regular slave out in the field. So I wasn't cast, and I lost a lot of time and career. But instead, I took it as just the media's problem and how they project a black person to be. It's like early civil rights when department stores hired only very, very black people because they wanted to show that they had hired black people. It's just part of the media thing right now. And I feel like I can be really well used in the next couple of years of introducing some new black images to the media and to people.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I just want to reintroduce you both for our friends who are just tuning in. Just speaking was Vernell Banarese, who is the creator, director of One More Time, the 1920s New Orleans musical. Also with us is Morten Larsen, who's from Norway and recently came to the United States. And Morten's at the piano, and Vernell is going to continue doing some singing for us. And I'd love to ask you to do another tune for us.
Uh-huh. Well, okay, great. Is that Jelly Roll Martin? No. It's being done now in all the cabarets, all societies. Gone and got the craze. It's the best dance done in modern days. That is why I rave about it so. All join hands now. Start to clap your hands. Old folks, young folks, learn to do the prance. I'm gonna show you just how to do the dance. Watch me and I'll show it all to you. First you put your two knees close up tight, then you swing them to the left, you got to swing it to the right. Step around the floor kinda nice and light, and then you twist around with all of your might. Stretch your loving arms right out in space, and then you do the eagle rock with lots of style and grace. Put your foot way out, now bring it on back. That's what I call balling a jack. Up tight, you swing them to the left and then you swing them to the right. Step around the floor, kinda nice and light. Twist around with all your might. Stretch your loving arms out in space. You got to do that eagle rock with lots of style and grace. Put your foot out now, bring it on back. That's what I call balling the jack.
Oh, that's great. Does anyone remember who wrote that?
I think it was someone called Chris Smith, back in 1916 or something.
It's funny how songs change. I remember when I was a kid, everyone used to, the kids used to sing that, and I never knew where it came from. I figured, well, maybe it's a kid's song, but I hated it when I was growing up. And about 2 years ago, I heard an old recording of it and realized that the song, the way we had all sung it, was really different than what used to be done. The way you did it was terrific. I really enjoyed that.
The thing too is using the verse, which
gets
skipped out so many times. It's a shame because the verse, particularly in vaudeville, it set up the character of who was talking to you, so that you know this guy is saying that he's going to show you this dance and come on, I'm going to show it. But if you just get the chorus all the time, you don't know where the song's coming from.
I don't know about you, Vernell, but I've found myself reevaluating a lot of music that I knew when I was growing up. Because, like a lot of Cole Porter, for instance, came to me secondhand through singers that didn't do a real good job of singing his tunes. And then you get older and you find out more about music and start being more selective and knowing where to go. And you hear great musicians and great singers doing it, and you start to reevaluate composers like that. Or songs like Ball and the Jack, you understand how that's not the song you thought it was. You reevaluated some music too.
Oh,
you started
God,
to
yes.
hear it differently than
completely.
You first did.
I had the experience that you had, but a lot heavier because my mother would sing a lot of things to me that I thought were old-time Creole lullabies or something like that. For example, Mama's Little Baby Likes to Ti-na-na and Ti-na-na-na-na. You know, just things that were like clap hands so Daddy come home. And I thought they were old Creole lullabies, but then I found out later they were really raunchy little songs coming out of the red light district, you know. And I got the real verses for them and had a lot of fun rediscovering, you know, just what I knew for, as a child and then taking it again. But yeah, it's been a whole reconstruction for me of going back to songs like Ball in the Jack or what's that thing? Well, anyway, just taking songs that I didn't know how they were supposed to be done.
Well, when I'd seen it done on like films or TV, that song was always done as a, you know, like a flapper nightclub, roaring 20s style. Now, Morton, did you ever have to unlearn or just reevaluate music since you weren't in the middle of American popular culture? You were outside of that in Norway, and you might have gotten like first-hand renderings of all the stuff that we got filtered through so many different kinds of sources.
Well, in a way, but my first encounter with ragtime, though, was on the out-of-tune rink-tink piano. And I had, after a while, to find out what this really was about. And then I was so happy because I found that it could be treated as serious music, just like any classical music. That was still what delighted me so much.
Are there a lot of like really bad singers and mediocre performers who do a lot of this material? And for some people, that's their first encounter with it.
Oh, I believe so.
Come On Alone, Alexander Ragtime Band is a perfect example.
Yeah, many of the commercial renditions are really terrible, you know.
What kind of stuff is on TV, for instance, or on the radio?
In Norway?
Yeah.
We have some of that, but maybe generally the program has more of a serious character than here in the States. We don't have commercials, for instance. Probably Channel 12 is pretty close to it.
I forget which country, but somebody heard, I think, one of John Coltrane's records in another country being played, I think, in a break between two television programs, or maybe behind a quiz show, which just seemed outrageous to me,
yeah,
since we either get like Muzak or Disco, depending on which,
yeah. No,
which the show is.
They use more serious music generally.
Can you do another tune for us?
Yeah.
I guess you could.
Why don't you do a solo? I'd love for you to do that tango piece.
Okay,
tango.
I can try.
And you don't get to hear tangos too much.
Is this a tango
by General Morton?
By General Morton.
Yeah, it's...
Oh, there's some Spanish influence in his music.
Yeah,
can you talk about that at all?
That was simply what this piece is about. I think it's more close to a habanero than actually what is called a tango. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he called it a tango. And the name of this one is The Crave. Thank you.
Sounds good. That's Jelly Roll Morton's The Crave, and playing that was Morton Larson. There are still people alive, musicians who are still living from the 20s, you know, who were playing in the 20s. Mm. And one of them was in the show for a while, Jabbo Smith.
Yeah.
I wonder when musicians who are still alive, who maybe still play, maybe don't, meet you both and hear you doing music of the period that they're from, how they react to what they hear when you play, like how they react to the fact that you're interested in it and the way you play it. What kind of reactions have you gotten, Vernell?
Well, Jabbo says, "That's fabulous." Humphrey, who is a clarinetist at... at the Lyric.
Yeah.
He said that he had played the Lyric and it burned down the next night, and he was glad I was reopening the concept because now maybe he'd get his pay from that week. in general, it's been flabbergasted and pleased. What's not only the old music, I want you to ask Martin about that too, but I wanted to just stick in for a minute, just not only the old musicians, but just the older people who remember the show. Our Sunday performances with the older people, our two Saturday matinee and Sunday matinee, where we get a large older crowd, it's a mind boggle to be on my side of the fence looking at them as far as delighted and memories and a whole thing passing in front of their face. It's really something.
What kind of reaction do you get from older musicians, Martin?
Yeah, I think it's great because they realize that you carry the tradition on, and it's very unusual
tradition.
So far.
Tradition.
Hmm?
Tradition.
Yeah, carry on the tradition, yeah.
Yes.
So they realize that it's not very often that it happens yet, but it's more and more musicians coming up. And I know a man like UB Blake, for instance, is now in his, I think he's 97 years old or something. He enjoys my playing very much because I try to put it close to how he wants his interpretations done.
There are a number of musicians in New Orleans who are literally preservationists. They grew up during that period of 1920s in New Orleans and have continued to play in that style. I wonder how you relate to that, if you think they're anachronisms or
well, it's not like, for example, you grew up on Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and then moved into disco or whatever. You know, I'm talking about not you in general. I mean, you in general. For them, it wasn't just a music of the time. It was a music that they created. And it was the best music to be created as far as they're concerned and a lot of people are concerned. So they hold on to it. It wasn't a passing fad in the 20s. It was a style that was created that was kept, and they've proven the point when today you can excite 1,500 people a night with that very music.
Do you think in any sense that musicians I hate to use the word responsibility, I don't know what word to use, that it's almost their responsibility to move and grow as the form that they're playing grows? And as an example, I guess I'd use someone like Earl Hines, who was a key musician in New Orleans in the 20s. And if you hear him now, he's like, his music encompasses just about every form of jazz that has developed since the 1920s, whereas preservationists, you could say, remain stuck in that period.
Moldy Figs. Do you have any ideas on it?
Is it due to you, you mean?
No, any ideas. Play it, dude. No, I don't see it as... I recognize both sides. I don't see one being bad, but, one being
bad. Right.
For example, my uncle, Vernell, my namesake, he was a very good New Orleans drummer. He went off to play with Ahmad Jamal. Yeah. He was a drummer on Poinciana and stayed with a trio. And he's developed. Now, he was in New York not long ago and thought it'd be fun to play the show. The problem is he can't anymore. He has lost the sense of the primitive. And not lost it, but he's doing the other thing so much that is sometimes the preservationists are staying where they are because that's the only way to really contain the authenticity and keep it all together, is not really letting in other influences in.
You know, Morton, I imagine you've met a lot of musicians who are from that era and play music as it was played then. But does it sound to you like it sounds on the records of that period, or does some change seem to have happened in their playing, even though they're playing in that style and of
that period?
You mean
because they're gained some age?
Well, either because they're older or because just in the last 50 years or so, something's changed in their play.
You realize some influence of later kind of music, like some of the Preservation Hall musicians play In the Mood, for instance, one of the Glenn Miller favorites. But one part that I think is very interesting is how much you can learn, even if the musicians are old. Sometimes their technique is not as good as it used to be, but after a while you learn how to listen to them and how to pick things that still are valuable that they do. You try to, rather than to listen to the ideas exactly, you try to pick what they want to do.
Exactly, yeah.
Not what is
with
coming
Jabbo,
out.
With Jabbo, a lot of
especially
evenings,
with
you, especially with Jabbo. With Jabbo, you could, all of us, after being in tune with Jabbo for about a year and a half or something, and being around him and knowing him, we knew a lot of nights where he was aiming to go. But when technically he didn't go there, he was a brilliant enough musician to still turn that somewhere very interesting. He'd fall short of the note, jazz it up, do a riff or whatever, you know, just do a, and come out winning each time. Mm-hmm. When we opened the show, I discussed Dr. Jazz and Jelly Roll with Martin, and Martin was playing Dr. Jazz.
Right.
But I was singing Jelly Roll. But by just turning it around and playing with Jazz has that kind of, there's that freedom in that music to win anyway. To use the lyrics, turn them around, make sense. As long as you're talking, as long as you're making a statement and it's a clear one and you fit within the bar, jazz is a very free form of music.
Yeah. Well, let me reintroduce you both. My guests are Vernell Bonarice, the creator of One More Time, and Morton Larson. And if you don't mind, I'd love to hear another tune.
You mean we both do the same one? This
time. No, I thought maybe you could both do different ones again.
Yeah.
And show us how creative you can be.
What would you like, something up or a bluesy piece?
I'll leave that up to you.
What would you like to hear?
How about a bluesy piece?
Okay. Aaron Harris?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. This is about a man in the district in New Orleans. Aaron Harris is a bad, bad man. Aaron Harris is a bad, bad man. On this land, he killed his sweet little sister and his brother-in-law. He killed his sweet little sister and his brother-in-law. About a cup of coffee, he killed his sister and his brother-in-law. He gets out of jail every time that he makes a kill. He gets out of jail every time that he makes a kill. He got a hoodoo woman. All he got to do is pay the bill. Mm-hmm. sleep.
That's one I never heard before.
Yeah, it's about a person in the a real person in Storyville, Aaron Harris, who's Jelly Roll talks about him on the Library of Congress tapes of playing pool with him and not realizing who he was playing pool with and how he had to lose if he wanted to get out of the pool hall.
Right. In the show, Vernell, one more time, you have the band on the stage. Mm-hmm. And that really struck me when I saw it, because in addition to being able to see the band that way, it struck me as also being a statement that the band was part of the show, that their music was as important a contribution as that of the singers and the dancers. Did I read that right? Is that a statement?
Yeah, it is a statement. They did center stage, and it's quite on purpose. They're fabulous. You know, we take... each one gets a chance to do a bit of a solo, but just in general, I want them right there. Because actually, what we're doing now is the show, the music opens the show and sort of conjures up the whole spirit of the lyric and vaudeville and the 20s. But it's all done from the spirit of the music.
Oh, I wonder if this isn't... something we'll be seeing more of, like more attention being paid to the music. And I'm thinking of like Innate Misbehavin'. Hank Jones is, or at least was, the pianist for that. Mm-hmm. And I sometimes wonder how that's affected his career, if at all, if people who leave that show have never been introduced to his music before remember his name or remember
I don't
his
think
playing.
So. I think that Fats Waller really got introduced as a musician into the general public's mind, and that was pretty much it.
Right. Martin, can you play something solo for us?
Sure, I'd like to. I'd like to play a piece that's mostly known today as a traditional Dixieland favorite, but that Jelly Roll Morton originally put together. At least he said so. He used to brag a lot about his music, and even said he invented jazz music. But at least he said he put this piece together from different dance themes from New Orleans, one of them original from an old quadrille. And he also said he named it because of an effect he used with his elbow in the part of it, and he named it Tiger Rag. Thank you.
terrific. What do you think? Your playing's been affected in any way by living in the United States?
Not so far, really. Not my solo pieces.
I think it has.
Yeah? In what way?
I've noticed.
What can you hear?
Okay.
More funk, you know, in it.
Yeah, that's nice, because that's what I really want.
That's maybe why you're here.
Yeah, that's maybe the thing I'm not aware of myself, but being in the surroundings where this music was created and is performed.
If you'd like to, we have time for one more short tune.
Okay.
Shake it and break it.
Okay.
You can hang it on the wall, throw it out the window, catch it before it fall. Shimmy, shimmy, wobble all night long. And I'm hearing that same old song. Now I'm going away, and I won't be back till fall. I'ma shake it, I'ma break it, I'ma hang it up on the wall. To catch it for it fall, shimmy, shimmy, wobble all night long. And I'm hearing that same old song now. I'm going away, and I won't be back till fall. I'll be shaking and breaking and hanging up all.